Uncovered World, a new show here on CamFM 97.2 with me, Raphael Kolber-Hoffman, and Jacob Arby. We'll be discussing the latest news, current affairs, around the developing world. Today, we're travelling east, staying in Europe, to Eastern Europe. And there, we will be exploring with Cambridge academics and student experts the latest issues in the region. Now, to explain a little bit more about this, in the Thought Bubble, it's Jacob Arby.
Eastern Europe is a region which has recently reasserted itself on the geopolitical radar. But in order to understand a lot of these issues and get behind the news, it's necessary, I think, to know some of the context. The vast majority of these countries have a heritage of post-communism, of fall of communism at the end of the 1980s, and of the challenge of adjusting their economies and of their adjusting their political systems to democratic, liberalized market economies over the 1990s. Indeed, this was the original purpose of the Visegrad Four Group, four nations comprising the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland, and helping each other in the mutual aspiration, which was widely shared across the region, of EU membership, which was by and large obtained in 2004. Since 2004, the region has recorded impressive economic growth. Poland, for example, was the only EU member state not to stop growing during the financial crisis. Hungary's had consistently strong growth, being one of the richest in the region, and Romania had the strongest growth in Europe recorded last year at 7%. This is by and large a new geopolitical phenomenon, and it may give them increasing clout and influence in the region. And talking about that, Raphael, would you explain a bit of the context in terms of the opposition to the European Union?
Yes, absolutely. So since the ascent of these countries to the European Union over the past decade and a half, it hasn't all been plain sailing for these countries. Indeed, in recent years, the migrant crisis has led to large opposition amongst the governments and populations of these countries to mandatory refugee quotas, which have been attempted to be enforced by the European Union, led by Germany. This has led to extreme propaganda spread by these regimes. Poland has published documents describing refugees as rats, spread disease. Hungary describes them as an army and uses frequently anti-Semitic imagery with regards to George Soros to malign what they perceive to be the spread of outside influences in their countries and thus the spread of a xenophobic type of nationalism. Now, this has led to a variety of consequences, indeed. It's the first real clash of values amongst the countries of the European Union, who, of course, when they decided to join, it was viewed as making an historical choice, as from a departure from the Soviet era and an arrival in a new liberal, democratic, and especially Western system of government. Now, this is not really proven to be the case. In fact, many of these countries, such as Poland, have been engaged in a type of democratic backsliding. They are becoming increasingly illiberal rather than joining the ranks of France and Germany, who have persistently espoused liberal values. For example, the Law and Justice Party of Poland, the current ruling government, have stuffed the constitutional court with their supporters. Hungary has attempted to repress the independent media. Now, the EU has to some extent taken them to task on this, attempting to introduce Article 7 against Poland. But of course, severe sanctions against these countries are difficult. For example, in order to properly sanction Poland in a way that many commentators view would be the most effective, it is necessary to have the consent of every EU member state. Now, this is not likely to happen with Poland's alliances with the equally xenophobic Hungary. And as a result, the EU and the Eastern European countries have to some extent reached an impasse. However, in the immediate moment, there is no likelihood of an exit of these countries akin to Brexit. Euroscepticism in these countries cannot necessarily be seen in the same way that it is seen in Britain. This is particularly with regards to the fact that these countries are not as rich, and they rely to a large extent on huge EU funds and subsidies. Indeed, the importance of trade with Germany to these countries makes it unlikely that they will seek to jeopardize this anytime soon. Nevertheless, this is not the only threat that these countries face. If they aren't sanctioned by the EU, they may face repercussions for their policies towards another country, which is also causing increasing concern around the region. Jacob explains more.
Eastern Europe as a region may be reasserting itself, but that is also coming with an equal reassertion, arguably, of Russia, viewed as the traditional hegemon in the region, largely maligned in these countries since the end of the Cold War. But since the Ukraine crisis in 2014, this has become increasingly complicated. There has been a large division between these nations on how best to deal with the threat of Russia. Poland, for example, has attempted to influence the European Union and NATO in a more anti-Russian direction, advocating for sanctions, providing military support to Ukraine, and advocating for stronger NATO safeguards within the Baltic states, which have large Russian populations, which many view as an entry of Russia, much like Ukraine. Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia have by and large been more tolerant, perhaps due to business ties and to some extent due to ideological ties, especially with the case of Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who held a summit with Vladimir Putin. And famously, Miloš Zeman, the President of the Czech Republic, has been an outspoken opponent of sanctions against Russia by the European Union. Meanwhile, to the east, this could have implications for Ukraine. The country has largely stagnated since the Maidan Revolution. There have been some promising economic and political reforms, but EU membership is a long way off. The country remains relatively undeveloped, having a GDP per capita equivalent to that of Swaziland, and the corruption remains endemic despite EU-led attempts to clamp down on this. The civil war prevents any meaningful change in either a pro-Russian or a pro-European direction, and it seems that the country has by and large reached an impasse. Essentially, the region, as it has always been, is riddled with differences of opinion, some contradictions, and ideological imperatives that are shared not even necessarily within countries or governments. If the US and Western Europe are to effectively counter the influence of Russia in the region, they will have to deal with these specific internal dynamics. And meanwhile, there is the increasing risk of spillover from conflicts in the Middle East. We've already to some extent seen this with the Syrian refugee crisis and the opposition to mandatory refugee resettlement quotas. But now, with the bombings of Syria by the UK, France and the USA, there is a risk of diplomatic collision with Russia and a military spillover, perhaps, into Eastern Europe.
And that, thank you, Jacob. That's it for the Thought Bubble, providing you with the context of the issues discussed in today's episode. Now, for today's main interview, Jacob travelled to Oxford, where he spoke to Julia Piezza, member of the Oxford International Relations Society.
I'm here now with Julia Piezza from the Oxford International Relations Society. Julia is a native Pole. She grew up in Poland before immigrating here close to the Russian border. And she's here today to talk about the view from the ground in terms of Eastern Europe as a exceptional cultural political unit, whether that holds true and what the future holds. Hello, Julia.
That's quite an introduction. Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. We've heard a lot about the notion of Eastern Europe reasserting itself. Obviously, you've had the economic success of the region since joining the European Union, but also in the last two or so years, reasserting itself as a geopolitical and even cultural entity in terms of the struggles against what they view as EU meddling in their states in terms of migrants, in terms of democratic values. In your experience, is there a sense of shared struggle in the EU? Is there a sense of shared culture even among the, particularly the nations of the Visegrad Four?
I guess, firstly, I would say that there's definitely recently been more of an effort of the Polish kind of the PIS party to engage with some of the ideas that Orban has been, you know, known for talking about in the media, such as immigration and all that. It's an issue that's perhaps a lot less close to Poland physically than Hungary, but there's been definitely many comparisons between Kaczynski and Orban, and that's really interesting because politically the countries seem to be at a somewhat similar place, although Hungary has perhaps gone further in its liberal path, but
And perhaps more outright ideological, I suppose. Viktor yeah. Orban has this explicit vision of illiberal democracy,
kind of including the Czech Republic and Slovakia. It's a lot more difficult for me to judge whether there is a conscious effort to present a united kind of cultural front from these countries, because I personally don't see it as often. I think there is definitely a political connections between Poland and Hungary, and this relationship has been growing in terms of how kind of politicians react in the EU Parliament and how they're sort of allied in a sense, in that Hungary will pose any kind of vote possibly to, you know, limit or kind of disadvantage Poland, and then Poland is kind of expected to do the same.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if, you know, it's definitely not a formal agreement, but it is sort of an understanding in that the two parties are populist kind of right-wing parties, and they have... They use kind of very similar rhetoric, but I wouldn't say I see much of a conscious drive towards presenting a culturally united front, even though all of the kind of Visegrad groups share very similar histories with kind of communist...
There's definitely a difference in approach in terms of the Czech Republic and Slovakia taking a perhaps more subtle approach. More willing to ally up to the more traditional powers of the European Union, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's maybe because the Visegrad group is, it's not as coherent as, you know, it perhaps was at the beginning when the country started entering the EU, where, you know, they had such a similar history, kind of, that was very recent.
In terms of that shared communist occupation and liberation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, thank you. So thinking about these right-wing populist parties, as you've called them, Jaroslaw Kaczynski's Law and Justice Party was regularly topping 45% of it in the polls, and it seems to lack a real challenger in European councillors, Donald Tusk's former Citizens Platform Party. Why do you think Law and Justice maintains its popularity amongst Poles, even in the face of clear democratic backsliding? And how do you think Poles tend to rationalise this?
I think, fundamentally, what we've seen with a lot of populist politicians is that there is a lot of rhetoric about a group that has been, you know, either left behind, or a group that just, you know, deserves more out of politics and, you know, deserves to, you know, have a say finally.
So, and similar that's to what we really see in the West.
Yes. And that's a really appealing rhetoric. And I think in Poland that manifests itself in the fact that we've seen a lot of corruption from the PO party, and just kind of the ruling classes, the very kind of elitist nature of politics, that has been a problem, and it was failed to kind of address. But PIS is effectively doing the same thing right now. There were scandals about kind of reshuffles and people getting huge bonuses and protests about that. So I think it's not like PIS is making change.
Yeah, and so you think that if corruption and a sense of elitism brought PO, the Citizens Platform, down, do you think that that has the potential to do the same for Law and Justice? Do you think that their position is perhaps less stable than the
Polish? In a short answer, I think yes. It really depends on how far they kind of get to make the system work for themselves. How much do they get to meddle with the constitution and the courts? And, you know, that could really make it a lot more difficult to them to fall from power.
I know, obviously, with Hungary, you've got Orbán's recently got back his supermajority because of, arguably, election meddling and countdown of free press.
Yeah, so that's definitely an issue. But I do think there is I do think that PIS polls so high up is because it has promised a lot to do a lot, and it has to some extent achieved it
in terms of the plus
kind of social policies.
Could you just give an outline of what that is?
So there's the 500 plus policy, where it is 500 zlotys, the Polish currency, for kind of every child a family has. It was a policy that was passed kind of in a very rushed way. There weren't many definitions of, you know, who was going to be able to apply for this and all kind of that kind of bureaucracy. And it is just kind of economically unsustainable. And that is what's worrying kind of, you know, the economists and the economic community in Poland, essentially. So while it may look and deliver very short-term effects, it is kind of very unsustainable in the long term. I think we've seen that with, you know, some of other policies of PIS, kind of defunding infrastructure.
Which, of course, the EU has to step in terms of contributing to, ironically, perhaps.
Yeah. So I think there's definitely a variety of reasons of why people have reacted to the failures of, you know, the centre-right PO and the promises of the populists and have been somewhat seduced by them. But I do think there is a very strong backlash to it that's been very visible, and that can achieve a lot. So, and I don't think, you know, we've seen women kind of come out against limiting abortion laws. We've seen people come up against the manipulation of courts. And I don't think PIS's position is as stable as it may seem, but I do think it will take a lot from the kind of more liberal centre-right parties to do their part.
Ultimately, it may be these kind of more bread-and-butter issues, corruption, the economy, that take down the seemingly unassailable position of these national conservative regimes.
Yes, perhaps, but PIS has also been driving a narrative against immigrants, a narrative against essentially history to some extent, in that, you know, the national curriculum has been changed quite a few times. And
there's the Holocaust bill.
Yes, that's also very worrying. I mean, a personal example is that I've had a cousin who hasn't had a history teacher for about 2 months.
Wow.
And she's just not learning it. You know, maybe that's because of a shortage of teachers as well.
But it could. It does also represent.
Also, that a lot of teachers don't want to teach the new curriculum. And they're just kind of changing.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
And I understand, moving on, thinking more about the geopolitics of the region, perhaps, you've written on the changing face of Polish-Ukrainian relations since the fall of communism. Could you quickly give us a brief outline of that?
So my article was sort of a personal exploration of how Polish-Ukrainian relations kind of manifested themselves in my life. And even though I haven't lived in Poland for 9 years, I think it's very visible that there's definitely recently been a strain of the community.
The Ukrainian community from your hometown.
Yes. And across Poland, I think there is a lot of integration, and my article describes the festivals that kind of both communities attend and the kind of schools which do integrate. But it's definitely, I mean, at least the impression that I got from visiting recently was that there were some provocations by very right-wing kind of Poles, and on the other hand, very kind of right-wing Ukrainians who battle out between each other, and then the people in the middle don't really know what to think.
And there does seem to be a kind of competing, sort of historically even, narratives. In Ukraine, you have the rehabilitation of Stepan Bandera, who was a World War II resistance leader, notorious for massacring Poles and Jews.
Yeah.
And Poland not really facing up to its own past of deporting and ethnic cleansing of Ukrainians.
Yes. And I think both of these issues need to be addressed. And I think there is a lot of unwillingness to do that fundamentally in terms of education, in terms of politics currently. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about these issues. It's kind of manifested in popular culture through films such as Volyn. And through kind of Facebook groups and
Avoim being about the massacre.
The massacre, Bandera.
Yeah.
So I think there needs to be more of an effort to discuss these things. But in the political climate, sometimes these kind of, you know, the popular culture can kind of very much swing people who would normally kind of stay in the centre and not engage in kind of nativist debates, but it can seem like the kind of stereotyping a whole group of people, a whole nation to be like this has become more common. And I don't think it's just happening in the East
and
or in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, perhaps we need to look at Eastern Europe as part of a wider global trend. You know, we've spoken about national conservatism, national populism, a sense of disconnect, ethnic scapegoating, especially see that with Orban's regime.
Yeah. And
perhaps this actually undermines the notion of Eastern Europe as its own unique unit, or Eastern Europe exceptionalism, as you would.
I think it's definitely been reacting to the success populists have had in adopting some of the kind of rhetoric of that.
And perhaps tragic, because Poland has historically been one of the biggest champions for Ukraine in terms of the European level, on the level of NATO. Do you think that that could have implications for Ukrainian and Russian interactions with these two blocs?
Do you mean having Poland no longer be this vehement ally having the impact? I think very possibly, but I think it's also a matter of looking at the divisions in Ukraine currently and the fact that a lot of the population do feel attracted to the stability that Russia can provide to some extent. It's sort of becoming appealing again. And I mean, I don't know to what extent this is, and I don't want to speculate, but it's an interesting thing to look at the divisions in Ukraine with itself. But I do think it's always been the case that, you know, if Ukraine and Poland are not allies, Russia benefits. And that is kind of understood across,
and that's been
both nations essentially
for hundreds of years.
Yes,
quite constant.
Yeah,
thinking back to the Cossacks. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. But thank you very much, Julia Piesa. It's been a real pleasure. I think we've learned a
lot. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much to Jacob Arby, who recently spoke with Julia Piesa of the Oxford International Relations Society.
We'll be speaking to William O'Reilly, who is a fellow of Trinity Hall and a scholar of early modern Europe. He's taught across Europe, including the universities of Graz, Galway, Vienna and Budapest's Central European University, and is a fellow at the Weatherhead Centre for International Affairs at Harvard.
His interview coming up now.
Do you see any parallels with the recent Polish Holocaust laws criminalising the mention of Polish complicity in the Holocaust, which has indeed inspired resistance both within and without? And do you see a parallel in these regimes' need to control history and to instrumentalise history for their own purposes?
Again, I think that's really a crucial point, and what we see is an attempt to homogenise and simplify notions of national or ethnic identity. There is one type of Hungarian, there is one type of Pole, and these were always a certain simple national type. I mean, it's self-reliant on a very crude understanding of external views of 19th century nationalism. It's unfortunate that there is a retreat into that form of isolationism, a fetishization of some type of rural nature, which is anti-cosmopolitan, and by its very definition then, in an early 20th century sense, anti-Semitic and anti-international.
I'd be interested to sort of zoom in on this idea of Russia as perhaps or Russian Putin-style regime as perhaps the result of the kind of accumulation of these authoritarian policies by regimes such as Kaczynski's in Poland, such as Orban's in Hungary. But at the same time, these regimes do seem to display a remarkable difference in terms of their attitudes towards Putin. Orban seems happy to have a summit with him, while Kaczynski has lobbied NATO quite hard, I believe, for increased sanctions against Russia. Poland has been involved in the training of troops in Ukraine. Many put this down to different historical experiences of Russia. But thinking back to 1956 in Hungary and even beyond, both have significant legacies of Russian occupation and conflict. So why the difference in approach and interpretation, in your opinion?
I think there are many things that these governments share, and there are many that divide them. Let's look at what they have in common, first of all, in my view. They're populist regimes. That means that they're also, to an extent, connected with what we see in Macron's France or in Trump's United States, and that is electorates responding to what they perceive as being cultural, but also largely economic problems or challenges. In the case of Poland, a colossal emigration from the country of a dynamic section of the population, a large number of people under the age of 25 and 30 in the latter years who've emigrated to Western and Central Europe seeking employment. Poland is now a country of remittances. What that means is that the perhaps more active voices remaining in the state, and I'm not saying this is the entire reason, but in Poland in particular, are those of a particular generational background who are perhaps more rural than urban and who are retreating into a form of earlier understandings of cultural nationalism. It's about faith, it's about fatherland, and that relies on an historical understanding of victimhood, which is specifically connected with pan-Slavism coming from Russia. So looking across the borders at people we in part understand, I mean that literally and figuratively, and in large part understand all too well as being a great threat to us. The situation is radically different in Hungary. Yes, it has also an experience of Russian involvement, but at a remove. And while Russian army forces were there, they were never to the same extent present in Hungary as in Poland, never to the same extent involved in cultural life in Hungary. And let's not forget, too, that Hungary is, by very definition of its linguistic particularities and its cultural isolation in terms of its nine neighbors, it's neither Romance, nor Germanic, nor Italic, nor Slavic. And so it's always retreated into itself in terms of its old cultural vibrancy as a way of defending its own particularities. And that, too, I think is under threat in recent years because Hungary has become a country of emigration. Population-wise, much smaller than Poland, and so the size of emigration from Hungary, while in real terms significantly smaller than from Poland, has had a dramatic impact in recent years, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, on what life is like in small communities, particularly in the east of Hungary. And so that's one to watch, what immigration is doing for the population of Hungary. That troubles me a little.
Now, Jacob and I had the pleasure of attending this week the Cambridge Forum for Geopolitical Studies and their conference on the new geopolitics of Eastern Europe. And yeah, so it was a very interesting event. We very much enjoyed attending, and it explored, Jacob, its intention was to explore the intermarium and the ideas behind the colloquium. Now, I, for one, was not familiar with these terms once I arrived, but perhaps you could explain a little bit more about what they mean.
So the methodology, I assume, of the Cambridge Forum on Geopolitics is that they will take a historical idea that has been relevant in another age and see what looking at current geopolitics through that lens can achieve and can draw out. And the idea that was chosen for this conference was the idea of the new intermarium. The intermarium, or as it's known in Polish, Miedomorce, was an attempt in the interwar period by the Polish leader Marshal Joseph Piłsudski to unite the group of small, recently established states who had got their independence after World War I in order to resist an increasingly aggressive Germany to the west and an increasingly aggressive Russia to the east. And to a large extent he failed because other countries saw it as an attempt at Polish dominance, which had some credibility considering that when Piłsudski first put forward the idea, Poland was literally at war with Lithuania and taking their capital. But increasingly today, it's being used to discuss the idea that Poland may be forging a new coalition, a coalition opposed to perhaps some of the more liberal values of the European Union, but at the same time very heavily security-focused, based on military cooperation and collaboration, and whether they may succeed where Piłsudski failed.
Absolutely, and another theme that was explored at the conference is how many people think of Eastern Europe as being kind of as a borderlands, as in doomed to be influenced by the powers around them, particularly Russia and Germany, but also further afield in France, Turkey, and the United States. And this plays a role, of course, in its geopolitical importance. But was the consensus at the conference that this is still true, or are we in fact recently seeing an assertion of their independence?
Well, as we've said, the increasing economic successes of Eastern Europe, and particularly the Visegrad group, has led to some claims of independence. But it's perhaps more complicated than that. In the realm of economics, these countries were still, it was pointed out, heavily dependent on EU structural funds. And in the realm of defence, they are still, by and large, heavily dependent on NATO, not just as a guarantor of security, but also in terms of materiel and soldiers. There are thousands of US troops in Poland and the Baltic states, which has been increased since the Ukraine crisis. And Britain and Poland recently signed a defence compact, which is the first new one signed with a European country in several decades by Britain. It's quite interesting to see this, and by and large they do seem to be conforming to George Bush's defence secretary's vision of the new Europe as the most fervent Atlanticists, those that are most in favour of transatlantic security and ideological cooperation, even if they don't necessarily always conform to those liberal values.
And in that context, what do you feel we could say about, or indeed what was the conference's opinion on the future of this US involvement in Eastern Europe and also the influence of Russia?
Well, the US has had to turn its attention back to Eastern Europe, a region it thought it could leave to its own devices in the wake of the Ukraine crisis. It's been previously focused on the Middle East. And we have seen increased activity in the area, increased troop movements, but also increased Russian aggression and assertion. However, Russia is, by and large, much weaker than it seems. The consensus seemed to be that it was a bit of a paper tiger. It had a stagnating economy, a corrupt political system, and one that was perhaps much more vulnerable to change than Vladimir Putin's seeming iron fist would suggest. However, it was also pointed out that when Russia feels weak, it tends to get aggressive, and that does not necessarily bode well for the future. So the future, although there were differing opinions, seems the consensus seemed to be that there it was very unpredictable, but there was an increased risk of conflict, even if the US did maintain a hegemony.
Thank you very much, Jacob. And that seems to be most of what we have time for this week. Make sure you join us next week, where we'll be travelling to the Balkans. We apologise for any construction noise in the background of today's episode, and we look forward to having you again soon.